Well, hey everybody, thanks for joining us on the podcast. We are in this little mini series talking about spirituality and mental health, and there are a whole stack of mental health professionals in our church, and I've got a couple of them here with me today, right here to my right. Robert Williams, hello.
Hey.
And Brittany Williams.
Yes, hey.
Thanks so much for joining us. This is cool. I'll tell you something you don't know yet. I am notoriously bad at remembering names, like really bad. I make fun of myself about it because I'm so uncomfortable about it. I can only know to make jokes. I'm just really bad. And I try to do better. And so I play little games to try to remember names. The recently retired superintendent of Blount County Schools is a guy named Rob Britt. And your names are Robert and Brittany. And when I met you, I think the second time, and I was embarrassed because I'd forgotten your names. I just picture your heads on his body, or vice versa, and that's how I can remember
that. That's us.
It's that really us. Weird. Just like desperate to remember names.
Just a good image there. Yeah.
It's really funny. I particularly enjoy her head on his body. That one's that was the
that's
most
a good one.
Off-putting and unsettling image. That
I get out. It's like a filter. Yeah.
Brittany, let's have you go first. Tell us just give us a quick bio so people know who they're talking to and kind of where you're coming from, type of work that you do, have done, just whatever you want us to know.
Yeah. So I'm Brittany Williams, and I grew up here in Maryville, lived here the majority of my childhood, and didn't move away until college. So my family still lives here, which has been really nice, but moved away, went to North Carolina for college, and then Johnson City for grad school. And that's where I got my PhD in psychology. And then in psychology, it's interesting because it's kind of like medical school where you go into a lottery and then they sort of pick where you go for your clinical training. And okay. So they picked for us to go.
I would hate that.
That just it's really nerve-wracking.
Like out of control.
Yeah. I mean, you get to choose where you interview and or where you apply, and then you get interviewed. And then after that, it really is a lottery system. And so we moved to Pennsylvania, which we never thought we would live in Pennsylvania, but and not just Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania was a pretty rural area. Yeah. It's a town of 4,000 people. I'm pretty small. So we actually moved up there. We loved it and we stayed up there for a while, until we had two children, and then COVID hit and we were pretty isolated and lonely. And we needed help. So we moved back here to Maryville, to be closer to family and to get some support from our family. And I think COVID really highlighted for us that family was really important to us too, and we wanted to be closer. So made as many people did during COVID, made a whole career, life, cross-country change and move, and it's been really good since we've been back.
It had a way of saying, okay, what are we about? What's the most important to us?
Exactly.
What do we value the most? Yeah. How are we hurting? Where can we find what we need?
Yep.
That's good. Well, thank you, Robert. Yeah. How about you, ma'am?
Sure. Yeah, I'm not from Maryville, but I'm from outside Nashville, Middle Tennessee. Moved over here to the Knoxville area, went to UT. I sometimes get the reputation of being the guy always wearing orange, even though I'm not like a big football person. I just like the orange. So I always
like
have
UT
something.
Orange,
like UT orange? UT, you know.
Obnoxiously bright UT
like I've
orange.
Looked up the hex code and all that, you know, kind of thing. So I don't know. Yeah, but I loved it there. Got my bachelor's and master's there. Went in the social work, not psychology. But got my education there. Was a total weirdo dating online and met my wife there.
Yeah, I didn't even mention how we met.
Yeah.
That wasn't part of my story.
I just think the total weirdo tag on that just has to go. Like,
it actually wasn't that weird. It was
what feels weird now is like we met in person at a place, face to face. It's like you did. How fascinating. How does that work? So
I think it was kind of just weird. It worked out, but
2011. Yeah. It was not typical.
2011. It was weird.
It was kind of weird. Yeah. But we did it and we succeeded.
It worked out. Yeah. In the big scheme of things. Yeah. So we, so we got together. Obviously we both recognized we had an interest in mental health. So that was a bonding point and interest in faith. And so of course that was important. Got married in like a year, and then Brittany's like program has us moving around, you know, like she said, Johnson City and then up to Pennsylvania. And then my background, I don't have like a doctorate or anything like that, but with the clinical license and my experience, I wanted to have some really good quality therapy experience, which I can tell more about later. But long story short, she was involved in this program at the first job I had with my master's, which was teaching this like group therapy for folks with like kind of self-injury and suicide, high-risk, you know, teens.
Ooh.
And I got into it, and of course everyone's like, this is super weird. And I was like, no, this is great. I need this. I love it. I really liked the structure, but I liked all the components, and ended up like doing that. Ended up being a very important like element I took with me throughout you know, the last several years.
Wow, that's interesting. You know, I was I actually ended up before right after I graduated from college, I ended up in a clinical setting doing therapy. Not qualified at all. You guys are not qualified. I hadn't done any of those things. I was just, I think they were desperate. And then, but I'm in this clinical setting and I had to do a group, like a group therapy session. And it was primarily about, and it was with teens, just like you said, and we were talking about self-harm. And I just remember thinking, I'm drowning. I am drowning. We're talking about them being distraught, and I was like, I'm definitely the most distraught person in this circle. And so it just goes to show God wires up people a little bit differently, because you were like, yep, this is it. And me, I was like, never again. That's not gonna happen. So you mentioned kids. Tell us ages and names and such.
We have two kids. A two-year-old named Isla and a four-year-old named Bennett. So we're very busy.
4 and 2 is wild.
Tired parents.
We have 4 and 2 for a minute, and that, I mean, for about a year, I guess. And it was, oh man, we sometimes reference 4 and 2. It's like, remember 4 and 2? It's like, oh yeah, I remember 4 and 2. So I I hear you on that. It's amazing. You guys look bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and I'm impressed.
It's because we have help, and we moved here, and we have support.
Grandparents.
And
they're absolutely
awesome. Melatonin gummies.
Melatonin gummies at night.
Whatever it takes, man. Whatever it takes. So it's pretty unique. So you guys, I think, are just a fascinating scenario. What is it like to be a mental health professional while being married to a mental health professional? Like, does that have, that's got to have some strange dynamics.
Yeah, I had to learn some rules very early on. And they still took a while to settle in. Like, the first place that I went, like I said, I worked at, and she was, you were interning there? What were you doing there?
Yeah, I had like a practicum at that.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, there.
And so my thing is like, oh wow, here's this real juicy thing. I want to get consultation. Oh, and here's this, you know, hot gal. I'm definitely going to consult with her. And she's like, oh my gosh, please, can I not talk to my husband about like suicide cases or something like that? Can I just like compartmentalize that away?
Gotcha. So it was like, yeah, we're going to bring work home and we're going to, and he was like, nope.
Right. Yeah.
I think those lines were really hard for me. You know, in grad school, you just like devote all of yourself into grad school, to learning. And so it was hard for me to create boundaries just because I was so curious about what I was learning and wanted to continue to learn and wanted to talk to my husband about that. But it was really overwhelming. So I think we learned a few things over the years. Like, one of the things we learned is that we should not work at the same company. We've done that a couple different times. And the lines between home and work and creating boundaries are just more difficult when you do that versus if you work at different companies. You know, we protect our clients' privacy and we're not in the same consultation groups and things like that. So there's clearer boundaries there, and that's one thing that we learn and we really stick to, is that we should not work for the, same.
And you're not just like filling up my tendency. We're in a car ride and it's quiet, she's like, great. And my thought is, it's quiet. Like, let's talk about something. And it's good, though, if you fill up that quiet time with something like about us or about your goals or your dreams, and not like, oh wow, this like crazy benefit went away at work or some work drama or something.
Sure. Yeah.
So that was,
I can relate a long lesson on some levels, just a bit of over. I'm a pastor married to a pastor and we had to fight for those boundaries too. Mm. And then also not make them so hard and fast because, this isn't just a job for us. So it's like, actually our church community and our family here, we don't want to just not ever talk about that when we're at home, because that's a that's not a boundary we want to even maintain. And so we have to sort of figure out this sort of semi-permeable. But beyond just that, I find myself like trying to, maybe you guys can relate to this, when Sharon needs something from me, I'm thinking, does she need, do I need to be in spouse mode right now or do I need to be in pastor mode? Do you guys find yourselves having to switch hats? Okay, I'm going to be a spouse. I'm actually going to do some therapy. Like, do you feel that tension at all?
It's difficult because we are both very intellectual people. And when you're doing therapy with someone, I think what's protective for the therapist is that you are somewhat intellectual. You have to think about not just what the client's bringing in that moment, but also like what, how you're going to help them and like how you're seeing the problem and how you're going to help them navigate through that. And so you have to stay a little bit intellectual. So,
and not part of the, inner emotions.
Yeah. So part of the challenge of being a partner, like being married, is that staying intellectual can really be harmful. And so we've had to learn the hard way, I would say, of like how to be better partners for each other and be more emotional and supportive in that way.
Yeah. So can you catch the other person being like, oh, you're staying intellectual here and I'm wanting you to connect with me emotionally? Is that, do you?
We've definitely had, and it's, I feel like I'm usually the one at fault with this one, but like we've definitely had some conversations where it's been like, okay, you're trying to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. You want to go and like call someone or email someone, like, please don't. Mm-hmm. Like, can I just talk to you about it? And can you just be there? Like, and I think both of us have been in that role, like, or swapped at times where it's like, I actually don't want you to think at all. Like, I just want you to listen and like just be there, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that like kind of goes against the reflex. Yeah.
That makes sense. So, Brittany, we talked a while back and you were explaining that, and I didn't fully understand it. You did a great job. This is my own limitations. You were explaining how, you guys are both mental health professionals, but you kind of practice a different kind of modality. You different styles of how you help people or different areas of expertise. And so, can you explain what that distinction is, or either of you help me?
Yeah, I would say we're sort of in the same branch, but we feel passionate about different populations. Okay. So Rob, like he mentioned, feels really passionate about working with people who feel or have chronically suicidal thoughts or have a history of self-injury and things like that. And there's a specific modality that's used for that, that's recommended for those type of problems, called dialectical behavior therapy. The history of sort of like my career trajectory has been working with people in healthcare settings. And so I did a lot of work in oncology, working with cancer patients, and also worked in cardiology and just like general health problems and helping people navigate living with a chronic medical condition and also helping them with their mental health, you know, through those. So
can I interrupt you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
just so you can repeat it, because my mind was blown. You worked with how many people all at once? Like it was at like 7 different locations and trying to help through the most, what sounded like the most difficult times as people are dealing with a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was basically in charge of, there were 17 cancer clinics and they really hadn't had any mental health providers.
So how big was the team of therapists that you were working with for those 7?
It was me and like a couple interns. So really, really impossible. It was an impossible task. But to your point, like with really hard personal challenges that people were going through. So it was really heavy work. We did a lot of work with helping people prepare for dying, and that was really heavy. But also super important. And so just spread really thin and didn't have, you know, the capacity to really help people in the way that we wanted up there. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. That's so intense. I cannot imagine.
It's like the movie, the part in the movie where they're like, oh, the reinforcements aren't coming. You know, that's us.
Kind of. Yeah. Just me. Yeah. Yeah. And then it worsened, you know, and then COVID hit. Yeah. All of our patients in the cancer center still came in. I mean, they still had to come in for cancer treatments. It's not like everybody was able to just stay home. And that was a really scary time for a lot of people with cancer and navigating COVID. And
Guys,
what really was it like having your jobs during COVID? I mean, what happened? It sounds like it would be so intense.
It was pretty intense. We both were sent home. So we did teletherapy for a while at the beginning of COVID. I found out I was pregnant with Isla a week after we were sent home.
Right.
So I was grateful, to be honest, because I was pregnant and sick and be able to put my feet up, you know, during the day and also see clients. But it was pretty isolating. We didn't have a lot of community up there. The church that we were a part of up in Pennsylvania wasn't super supportive during COVID. And so we just felt very alone. And then we're trying really hard to help people in the work that we were doing in mental health.
Yeah.
It's almost as if people who work in mental health have all the same challenges as everybody else. And when the intensity of COVID just cranks everything up while somehow cranking everything down at the same time, and we're all just sort of in that vice, like, you're right in that same spot, but then also trying to help people navigate the very things that you're facing. I would think in your roles, a lot of times you're hearing people as they're describing their problems, maybe more so than ever they're describing your problems.
And we're big proponents of going to therapy. I think the challenge for mental health providers is when you live in a community, you typically know the therapists in the community too. So you can't go see your colleague for your own mental health problems.
Yeah.
So it becomes challenging to find good mental health care as a mental health provider.
Or if you're like me and you kind of become a bit of a snob and you're just like, oh, you know, you're way overpriced, or hypnotism won't do it, or whatever.
That's not the right way.
Yeah.
That's kind of close to something like I'm so confused by, frankly. You guys don't have to solve this problem for me right now, but they're like these different therapeutic modalities, like different approaches that people take.
Sure.
And it's really confusing. I was thinking about it and I was like, I think that's how maybe someone new to the faith feels about denominations in the church. It's like, well, they're all about Jesus, but they're all just a little different. Mm-hmm. And some of them are a lot different. And sometimes they don't agree with one another, but they have the same foundation. Like, it gets really confusing. And I'm wondering if, you know, does that sound like a fair parallel with denominations in a church? And so, yeah, it, you know, I just, I'm actually pretty excited about it because I think it's kind of interesting, but I just ordered a big thick book explaining these modalities through a Christian perspective, and I haven't even got it yet. But like, most people aren't going to buy that book, and it remains to be seen if I'll even read it. So most people just aren't. It's hard to kind of cut through all of that and see the forest for the trees. If someone is like maybe listening and they think, you know, I think I might need somebody to help me process and work through some stuff. Like, how do you start? Even, I mean, if you don't know all the whole lexicon of terms, any thoughts about where someone could begin or how they should try to find the right spot?
I can't help but think, like, if you start going and looking up therapy, the easy answer for me would be is what not to look for.
Okay.
And so like a lot of things, like if you watch movies and you are like, oh wow, you know, here's Good Will Hunting and, you know, Robin Williams is hugging Matt Damon or something like that, or you know, there's like a lot of dramatic stuff with like the therapist falling in love with the client, like stuff like that is fun for movies, but really what you need is a professional, and you want someone who seems to, like, not to kind of step away from my specifics with therapy, but like you want someone who prioritizes your goals, wants to help you get better as soon as you can. They're not just trying to get you in for as many sessions as possible, you know, like they're reasonable. And so a lot of times when I'm talking with clients, they're like, well, I've been seeing a psychiatrist and they put me on like 12 meds and I have eight diagnoses and I haven't gotten better. And I'll say, how long have you been seeing them? You know, 12 years. Yeah. I say, this is a crime. Run away.
Yeah.
You know, or if you're going, and I'm bad sometimes about getting on a roll talking in therapy, but I'm like, if you're going and your therapist is talking about their beliefs and their issues, like, why are you paying them? Mm-hmm. You know, so that's like the big thing. And a lot of the flashy stuff you hear on TikTok or Instagram or, you know, the Netflix thing. So, you know, if it's super trendy and new and flashy, I'm always like, be skeptical first.
Yeah.
Because good. The ways that you manage mental health, most of the time they're not glamorous and they require a lot of discipline and boring stuff like exercising regularly and, you know, having a social network, not online, but like literally like humans that you talk to and taking care of your health, going outside, and like good old like behavior approaches will do that. Like a lot of people are familiar with CBT, cognitive behavior therapy.
Yeah.
My kind of specialty, DBT or dialectical behavior therapy. If you start reading through those books, it's going to be a lot of stuff where people go, oh, this isn't like mysterious. Yeah. I mean, you're basically just telling me to do stuff that I've always been told to do.
It's like solid advice. I could, you know, learn from grandma or the farmer's almanac.
The main thing I'll say is that good therapy will basically, they try to encourage you to do things that you know are healthy and helpful, not go against your values so much, but maybe like reframe it, redirect your energy sometimes from unhelpful things. And they're usually good at helping you with self-awareness. Like, oh, wow. Like I've been doing this way for so long. Why am I doing this? You know, why do I eat tons of, you know, junk food? Or why do I, you know, drink all the time? Or why do I go from one relationship to the next? If you don't feel equipped, if you don't feel like, you know, or I'm panicking, what does that mean? To have a panic attack, like what does it mean for me? And so good therapy should be, if it's done well, I used to hear this, I should put myself out of a job.
And
what I do now is EAP, you know, employee assistance well, most of my clients are. And I tell them, like, if you've seen me for six sessions and you don't feel any better, like, I've done you wrong. Like, for the most part, you know, there's always going to be some exceptions. So that's kind of my take.
That just sounds really reasonable and level-headed. Like, let's not look for things that are flashy or hot or new or hyper-dramatic or magical thinking or mystical secret properties. Like, any of those things should be flags. That sounds really, really wise. What about you, Brittany? Would you add to that? Or?
I think the other thing to mention is that the majority of people have barriers to who they can go see based on their insurance and based on how much they're able to pay for services. And so I guess my thought is, as a therapist, if someone is brave enough to tell me I'm not getting what I need, or these are my goals and we're not talking about them, then I think, to me, I really value that as a therapist, because my priority is to my client and what they're there for, what they're coming in for, what they're paying for. And so if you're limited, like if you don't have very many options within your insurance or what you're able to afford, it's important to make sure you're speaking up for why you're there and what you need from your therapist, because you're paying them to help you. And I think a lot of people go in just hoping that the therapist is able to do something magical, and really that spending 45 minutes with a therapist each week is really magical and is going to change their life. And it really isn't. I'm here to say nothing we do is magical.
You can't, you can't just wave a wand and fix us.
But I do think the money thing is a huge barrier for many people.
It really is. Yeah. It is for a lot of people. Yeah. And well, I've heard some people say something along the lines of what really matters more than anything else is that you make a personal connection or you develop rapport. And I hear the logic of that, but I get a little bit concerned because I think it's not like rent a friend, you know, like right. That's not what we're trying to do. So what would you say about that? Just that mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll say this, and I don't want to like throw shade on anybody in particular. So I'll try to navigate this gently.
Good luck. Everyone's really listening.
I'm always good at like preambling the thing I don't want to do, but yeah. When I hear a lot of people who are looking for therapists now, especially since COVID, you know, there was some like apps and virtual therapists before that, but now it's like the norm, like 50% or something is like online therapy, if not more. And it's like a common trend now that you have this idea. I literally worked at a company where you were like incentivized to send messages to your clients every day, kind of like encourage them, and they could message you throughout the week. And I get it in the sense of like you're trying to have this like pro, like social, like healthy interaction,
right?
And you're like, oh, I've and you get a subscription to your therapist. It's kind of like I get a subscription to Netflix. Now I got my therapist. I'm covered.
Interesting.
But I feel like the problem is you start to think like, well, now that I'm set up, like everything is just gonna you know start rolling smoothly, and you still have to worry about your therapist's skills, their availability, and really like you don't want to figure out how to become self-aware and independent in your own life by having your therapist, you know, on the text, on ready, you know, hey, should I do this?
That seems like it fosters dependence instead of independence.
Yes. And I would run into that a lot. I mean, it's always a struggle with therapy. People will say in consultation, like, yeah, you know, I've been seeing this person for a while. They really need to, they're just lonely. They need to, you know, move on. So some of these kind of newer trends with having the subscription thing and the therapist can text you or message you throughout anytime you want. I don't know. I feel like that kind of further muddies the line.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it sounds like maybe the way I think about, I tend to think about church online, which is like, this is good. I'm glad we have this. There are so many concessions. I don't know how I feel about this. You know, like there's like a give and a take to it. What were we going to say, Brittany?
I was going to say, I do think it's important for people to feel connected to their therapist because the reason why is because it is really scary to look inward. It's scary to identify what your thoughts are and be honest about that, or notice how you're doing things in your life that aren't helping you and serving you and being honest about that. And so to develop a relationship with your therapist in order to build safety, I think is critical to therapy. So I agree in the sense that like just having a therapist as a friend, someone to chat with who you feel comfortable with in that way, is not the purpose of what we do in therapy, but it is critical to have a connection with your therapist and feel safe there. Otherwise, we as humans do things to avoid looking inward. And so it's really a difficult process. And we really are going to be successful with that when we feel comfortable with the therapist that we're with to dive inward. Sense. Yeah.
You're trying to establish some measure of trust. You have to open up. Totally. And so yeah, there's a balance there, I guess. I mean, Robert was nodding vigorously while you were talking. So there's definitely a tension there. You don't want to be overly reliant or dependent. But then there's got to be some measure of trust, or you're just not going to open up and be able to get anything done.
Yeah. I should add, I guess, just to, like, as much as I'm not like crazy about having like no boundaries, like with a therapist, and you can just like be a friend. You don't want them to just be a friend, but you want them to be friendly. And I've heard a lot of folks who've had bad experiences with their therapists. You know, basically they just don't feel respected by their therapist. And even if I have a client who does something and I'm like, I don't know, like that's kind of weird, or or, you know, why are you cheating on your spouse or something? It's not my place to be the person that also shames them and makes them feel awful. My place is hey, you may have never talked about this with another soul, and you're not sure if you're going to. So let us like be in this icky place together. So yeah, yeah, you've got to have some level of comfort and respect, you know, for the person's humanity.
Right.
You know, regardless of the issue. Yeah.
Yeah. So when I try to put some of this together, it's like, and this is where my mind goes, it's like, it's nuanced, it's multifaceted. There are different modalities, there are different personalities, there's different connections that you may or may not make. And like you might just have to try for a while. Again, my context is church, so I think in terms of church, but like, there have been plenty of people who are like, hey, I went to a small group, it wasn't really a fit. And I'm always like, yeah, it's often not. Here's a list of a whole bunch of other ones. Try again. And if we value something, it's worth pursuing. And so don't be discouraged that the first one isn't like this magic.
Right.
Well, we've already said magic's not part. You guys aren't magicians. So let's take all the wizardry out of it. But if it's not a clear fit, that's okay. There are other options. Yep. So, all right, I never know if this is just my own perception. It just, for the world, seems to me like people are dealing with anxiety and depression now.
Yeah.
And it just seems so elevated from where it was. I'm being vague on purpose, a few years ago. And maybe it's just my experience and who I've been bumping into or the conversations. Maybe I've got eyes that are looking for it now and there's biases, but it seems for the world to me that people are just more overcome by stress and anxiety and fear and depression. It just feels like it's a different context than it was a few years ago. And for me, at least, I can certainly highlight COVID as a force multiplier in that. But I would even go back before then and go, things have, to my eyes at least, have really been shifting. Are you guys feeling that, or am I reading between the lines too much? Is that your observation?
Yes, I would say yes.
Definitely.
It's definitely increased over the years, and I think, to your point, multiplied with COVID. But, you know, some of the research, particularly around depression and anxiety, shows us that the key factor in a protective factor against those two things is community, is people being in contact with one another and feeling safe in community. And COVID really tore that away from people and shut people away from their communities. And I would say before that, you know, through political turmoil, there's lots of breakdown of community that we've seen even before COVID too. It's certainly been on the rise over the last few years.
Definitely. Yeah. I have so many folks who are, you know, they're on different ends of the spectrum with their religious beliefs, their political, you know, even just their perspectives on mental health and everything. And a big thing I'll usually get, if not the first session, I'll ask them about is, you know, what are their fears? Because their fear is really like, to me, your fear tells me what's important to you and what's at risk. You know, and I think for so many people the last few years, there was a lot of cards on the table and then someone just like lit the match or whatever. Just rampant isolation, lots of illness, lots of changes at once. I'm not going to blame just COVID or economics or politics, but just a lot of things at once shifting and like fear of war and different things around the world. So there's a lot of stuff going on. People are afraid. And when you're isolated and you're afraid, it's very common to really get in your head, like Brittany said. But also, like, I can start inventing fears about you or her or anybody, you know? And now we're all against each other. And if we just had that tendency to, you know, have community, then it would very much safeguard us from some of that.
Yeah.
I do want to be clear, though, there is a distinct difference between anxiety and depression and sadness and worry.
Yeah. Right? I would love it if you helped us sort of parse those things out.
Vocabulary.
Because what we don't want people to hear is that community will solve the problem of ever feeling sad or ever feeling worried, but rather, like, depression is a problem of patterns of avoidance and thinking negatively and getting in a cycle of feeling down and isolating, yeah. To reach the point of, you know, clinical depression. So that's what we mean. Not that if you live in community, or if that you are vulnerable and you open up to the people around you, that you would never feel sad. Because that is part of the human experience.
Yes,
that's
it
how
is.
God made us. Yeah. Same with worry, that we worry about things and, that is part of the human condition, but it's not clinical anxiety, which is a pattern of avoidance and constant fear and worry, that takes you away from the present moment.
Yeah. So you were sort of already starting in on the question I was about to ask as a follow-up to that, which is what types of things should we be looking just in ourselves to say, okay, I'm becoming more worried, or I'm becoming more fearful, or more sad. Is that just more the human experience and the ebbs and flows, or at what point should I be concerned? You talked about patterns, or so like what types of things would we be looking for to go, okay, this is maybe I might need some help.
One of the patterns that I look for first is really, are you engaging in your life in the way that you want to? So is your worry or sadness or whatever internal experience that you're having, is that preventing you from living a life that's meaningful to you or one that you want to be living? And if it is, then that's a problem. That whatever emotion you're feeling or whatever thoughts you're having or whatever is preventing you from living a meaningful life.
Yeah, like not going in public,
yeah.
Not feeling comfortable driving, not wanting to go back to work, like things that if you really allow to like dictate your not wanting to go back out to date or go to the grocery store. I mean, different things, but like it really does feel like, oh, someone just like chopped this whole section of my life away. If I just listen to that fear, I just listen to those thoughts, you know?
Yeah, so like normal behaviors becoming cumbersome, or you start to avoid those things. Whereas in the past, that wouldn't have been the reality. Your life is shifting around in an ongoing way. Not, I woke up today feeling kind of blue. But, I woke up. I've been waking up that way for a long time, and I've been isolating, and I'm living a different kind of life, and it's affecting the day-to-day.
I think you can see a shift in people's thought patterns, too, that people tend to be more... I should say mean to themselves. Like there's not an allowance for the human emotional experience. So like if you wake up sad, I should not feel this way.
Yeah.
Things should be different. Or, you know, I think just adding that layer of like self-blame or self-evaluation is leading towards the path of depression.
I've never had any luck telling myself how to feel.
Right,
just does what it feel is. The same way, and then I add disappointed in myself for not being able to control the way I feel.
We call it clean. I always call it clean versus dirty pain. Like being a human is painful.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's clean pain. That's part of the gig of being human. But there's so many things that we do that make it worse, and that's the dirty pain. That's the disappointment that we add on top of it, or the self-judgment, or the isolating. And not enjoying life, you know, as much as we could. That's the dirty pain. And that's what we work with in therapy. We don't sugarcoat or try to pretend like we can change the human experience where you'll never feel sad again. But we can reduce the amount that you know, it's worsened or sort of self-blame and things like that.
Yeah, that's. I think that clean and dirty pain is a really helpful distinction. What you're saying is, this goes back to something Sharon and I talked about on a podcast about a therapeutic worldview, which is something entirely different than being in favor of therapy. And it's something different than having a Christian worldview, which in my eyes is the goal. And Christian worldview absolutely holds space for therapy, but the therapeutic worldview, at least the way we kind of framed it up on the podcast we did a couple of weeks ago, is the idea of peace at all costs. Just feel okay. Just feel comfort. Don't feel bad. And Sharon and I we're discussing how like no reasonable therapist would ever make that goal in front of you. And so that's part of the problem with the label therapeutic worldview, because people think it's, you know, about being for or against therapy, but any reasonable therapist is going to say, yeah, actually, life has pain. Mm-hmm. And there's actually, that can be part of what heals us and motivates us and helps us move forward. And yeah. And then, so that dirty, clean distinction, I think, is really, that's helpful shorthand. Mm-hmm. That's good. So let's shift gears just a bit here. Sure. And let's talk about mental health and spirituality. And you guys have both sort of shared some stories at points about how being a mental health professional, being someone who's deeply committed to their faith, these things should be perfectly simpatico, and yet sometimes those realities have bumped into one another. Brittany, I remember you telling me, I think it was when you were getting your PhD. Mm-hmm. Would you be willing to share that story with us?
Yeah. I knew that I wanted to become a psychologist. I was probably in high school. So I knew that I wanted to get my PhD in psychology. And so I entered that program, I think, with like bright eyes, like, yes, this is going to be awesome. And also as a Christian, into that program. And what I quickly found was that there is a clear distinction between secular counseling and biblical counseling. Mm-hmm. And so I was caught in between two worlds, to be honest, where we were very deeply involved in our church at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was totally invested in learning and becoming a psychologist in my very secular program in Johnson City. And so I had both ends. I had people at my church telling me that I was sinning because I was getting a degree in psychology at a secular university. And then I had people at my university, classmates, tell me that I was stupid for believing in God.
Oh my goodness.
And so.
So you're getting it from both sides.
I was getting it from both sides. And it really does, you know, like when you are learning, it really does make you stop and question, like, because my faith was most important to me, it made me question, you know, am I sinning? What am I doing? Mm. You know, what does God want me to be doing? And, instead of quitting, which is what I was encouraged to do from by people in my church, I decided to meld the two together on my own, to do even more studying and more learning so that I could find the commonalities. And
truth never runs from scrutiny.
Exactly. Stands the test. So I found a mentor, actually, who was a psychologist and a Christian. He introduced me to some resources that really showed that there is nothing new under the sun. So, you know, all the therapeutic models that we use, we can find the basis of those things from scripture and what God says about human nature. I also believe that science continually, and, you know, like all the research we do in psychology and the things we find out and are so amazed by, are again, like, point to scripture. There's nothing that we have found that says God is wrong. So to your point, like standing the test, it certainly does. And the only thing that did for me was sort of solidify my faith. And it also solidified that this is where I need to be in the secular space, helping people navigate the difficulties of life and not setting myself aside as only a biblical counselor, of which is essentially counseling from the Bible, using scripture to counsel. Now it's interesting because I really believe that God puts people in our lives who need to be there, and so God has funneled people my way and into my practice who I've had amazing conversations about faith and mental health, and have helped people grow spiritually in conversations, and have prayed with my clients before. So just because I am a secular counselor and I meet with a variety of different people from all walks of life does not mean that God isn't powerful enough to bring people into my
Absolutely.
Practice who I can help and
pray with. And I hate that even now there's almost a defensive, almost slightly apologetic tone to what you're saying.
Yeah.
Like, it just... Yeah. Shouldn't be that way.
Yeah, like I have to justify what I'm doing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is really unfortunate. And then I'm gonna go for it. We might end up cutting this.
We'll see.
But
it's a good one.
It might be a soapbox for you guys too, but I do not mean this as far as applying to absolutely everyone, I'm trying not to do that. But in some spots, I've heard biblical counseling framed up as, hey, we really believe in the beauty and the power of Scripture and its capacity to lead us and guide us, and which I love. And then also we've learned from science, we've learned from observation, and we've learned from things that are measurable, and we can put those things together, and everything in me is like cheering them right along. And then I've heard other versions of biblical counseling, and specifically those two words put together, that says we work from Scripture, and if you work from anything else, then you're just wrong, period. Mm-hmm. And I just, again, my little anecdotal experience is like, that's not proven to be helpful.
Yeah.
And you know, all truth is our truth. Like, if it's true, then it's just true, and mm-hmm. it's from the Lord, and we can use it. And I can't believe I'm saying this because I'm such a Bible guy. Like, I say it all the time. We always talk about just Scripture as the highest possible authority in our lives, the final arbiter on all issues. And yet, when I hear someone is seeing a biblical counselor, I get a little bit nervous and say,
yeah.
Hey, can I ask you a few follow-up questions about what that means? Because what is the wisdom in intentionally taking good tools out of our tool belt? So have you guys experienced that? Am I being unfair?
Not at all. We've personally experienced that. We believe in individual counseling ourselves. We believe in couples counseling. And we've been to couples counseling before. And we've been to biblical couples counseling. Mm-hmm. And those experiences have been really harmful to our marriage. Mm. Now, I don't want to, I think it's fair for you to say, like, when someone's a biblical counselor, to say, let me ask you some questions about how you practice, or like, yeah. what your method of biblical counseling is, because mm-hmm. I can only speak from like what we know and what we've encountered. But I think part of the problem is sort of like the shame-based counseling around like, you need to be praying more, or you need to be doing this more. And if you were doing those things, then you wouldn't be experiencing problems. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that people shut down. I mean, we even know that from counseling. If we tell people you need to be exercising, if you were exercising right. more, you wouldn't be depressed. We know not to do that because
don't let that be my mantra.
Shame-based counseling. It makes people feel worse. It makes people not feel safe with you anymore. And it makes people shut down.
Yeah.
And we want people to be open to take risks, to explore and challenge their internal processes, and also take risks out in their life. And in order to do that, they need to feel supported. And that's, I think, the line that was often crossed, at least with us, when we were in biblical counseling, mm-hmm. where we were told essentially that we were wrong, or that we must not be praying enough, or mm-hmm. reading our Bible enough, or whatever it may be, to be experiencing problems in our marriage or just in our emotional health.
Yeah. Yeah. So what bothers me about that is the term biblical counseling. I love the Bible.
Yeah.
Right.
And if
right.
it's shame-based or fear-based, then it's actually not biblical, no matter how many verses are quoted in the process.
Yeah.
So if you are seeing a biblical counselor, you're considering that, I'm not saying that that's bad.
Right.
But I am saying it's what you said. I'll repeat what you said. It's okay to ask some questions.
Yeah.
And try to clarify things. Rob, I think I stepped on you. You were about to say something there.
Well, I mean, if anybody has seen me a few times, they know I at some point will mention the words either futility or hopelessness. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, if you're feeling that, certainly if you're feeling it seeing me, then I want you to tell me that, because I want us to navigate. We want to see what causes that and work on it, mm-hmm. but we don't want therapy to be a place where you feel like you're just drowning. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to like a biblical counselor, like I want to feel encouraged, I want to feel close to the Lord, I want to feel like I'm on mission, all these good things. So I feel like if you are seeing a biblical counselor or therapist who is engaging you in a way that feels like you're able to do that, they're probably doing something right. If you've asked them these questions, right. nothing really alarming. But if they have this idea and you come away with, oh, well, I've tried praying and I've tried, putting blocks on my, phone, and mm-hmm. I've tried confessing every last weird thought in mm-hmm. my head to my wife, and I've tried doing all these things mm-hmm. ad nauseum, and mm-hmm. actually I don't feel better, I feel worse. Mm-hmm. And the therapist is going to A, get on to me, and B, tell me to do more of the same. They're going to encourage that futility. That is not therapy.
Right.
So that's, because therapy is all about getting better or healing.
Right.
So that's where I would say it's not, like you said, it's not about the Bible. And in the same way, like, people who have this idea, everything I need I can get from the Bible, it's kind of an unfair comparison. Mm-hmm. Because you wouldn't say that if somebody said, oh, I've got a problem with my toilet. You wouldn't say, why don't you go pray about it? You'd call a plumber. Or when you go to like the fast food or whatever, you know, any restaurant, you don't say, give me a Bible verse. You say, give me a sandwich. Uh-huh. So when you go to therapy, like, I feel like it's just a false comparison that people make, that like throwing a book at someone will, you know, somehow fix it.
And it can be, it's obvious how those things can be confused, because there is a tremendous amount of overlap between mental experience, between spiritual experience. There's lots of great sort of, there's lots of great counsel in Scripture that that will apply to almost any situation or to any situation. And the Holy Spirit is our counselor. Like these are biblical ideas. It just makes me sad to see other good tools being set aside as if they're not spiritual, when they've been, you know, found to be useful to people. And in my eyes, I see them as gifts from God. Then that's the common grace of God. If He's made this available to us, then, you know, just like He, you know, I've got a plunger available to me. You reference plumbing. I was like, I'm not going to not use it because I can't find a verse for plunger.
Right.
That's a pretty good way to, it's a pretty good way to think of it. Go ahead.
I also don't, you know, my perspective on therapy, you could disagree, but my perspective is it really isn't about advice giving. So if you are seeing, even if you're seeing a secular counselor, if that person is giving you advice on how you should do things or how you should navigate situations, then I would be, I would question that or be cautious about that. The therapist's role is to really help you discover and navigate what's working, what's not working, and help you decide on what the next steps are. And so that includes exploring who, what your identity is, what your spirituality is, what's most important to you. So like in my practice and in therapy, everything is game. I'm not going to give you, I'm not going to give you Bible verses, and I'm not going to give you advice on that. That's where I think there can be a beautiful pairing between like a counselor and a pastor, where the pastor can sort of guide spiritually and use the Bible for counseling and things like that. Whereas the therapist is really helping you navigate what's going on internally and making different choices that work for you and help you reach your goals and values in life. And one of those can be your faith and your spirituality. And that's where I think I personally and professionally struggle with biblical counseling, because I do see it as more of a coaching.
Kind of plug and chug.
Yeah, like you should be praying more, or like the you know, let's explore these Bible verses and like this is what you need to do or whatever. It just feels more directive and like more coaching versus kind of my approach to therapy.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I won't push back too hard. I am guilty of like sending people homework and handouts and things to look at, and I'll be like, oh, I think this, but I do that and I try, and if I have a client listening, you know, get on to me. I try to ask throughout the session. I'll say, but please tell me, like, do you feel this? Do you connect to this? Does this sound like you? Like, it's not about me. It's not about me knowing here's what you're supposed to be doing. Like, I, you know, we hate that. And I, even if it's something that's like the exercise you mentioned, even if it's something that like we know we should be doing, when somebody else tells you to do it, you get that defensiveness. So it really needs to be like, hey, I'm thinking this is like a tool that seems like it could be something good for you to explore. Give me feedback if that works. And I love it if someone comes back and says, no, Rob, like deep breathing, that made me worse. Like, you know, okay.
Yeah.
Like, let's figure out what works for you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, otherwise it's information without connection.
Yeah,
and right.
That's not super valuable.
Right.
And lots of us know better without doing better. And that's really not the problem. I think we all probably, I mean, by and large, we pretty much know what we should do. The problem is we don't do it.
Right, right.
So just, we already have directives.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But can you give us the tools to actually, you know, fulfill those things?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one more thought here. I just want, I'm probably really going to put you guys on the spot here. But last couple of weeks at church, we've been talking about how to accept God's love, how to trust God, and trying to be honest about how difficult that is, to accept and embrace the fact that we're loved unconditionally, completely, absolutely, that forgiveness covers all. I mean, it's hard. Then finding ways to trust, especially trust a God who we can't necessarily see or interact with the way we interact with one another. I mean, those, trust is hard always. So I wonder, since we've sort of been challenging the church to accept love and to move toward trust, and I've been trying to pull from my pastor tool belt to help equip people to do that. I wonder if either of you would have any suggestions, maybe pulling from your own tool belts to say, how can we, if we're really, someone says, I'm just struggling to accept love in any relationship, I'm struggling to trust, even when that trust would be a valid and reasonable kind of trust, and I can't, and I feel stuck. I wonder if there's any sort of way you might nudge or encourage people to maybe think about that, or some tools they might employ.
I think it's important to acknowledge that it is really difficult to do. I think the way we're hardwired as humans is that we want things to be simple and easy and complete. And so trusting God, I think, is a process, and it is continual. I mean, depends on the season that you're in as well. So there are going to be times in your life when it feels more difficult to trust, and other times in your life where it might come easier to you. And I think we all want it to be sort of like the same and sort of easy and really clear. And I think that's part of what we are as humans. We depend on God. So if we don't have moments of doubt, then we don't have points to turn back to God. So I do feel like it's this flexible process of opening up and trusting God. And so if you find yourselves in moments of like doubt or struggling or not trusting in God, one thing that I think keeps people stuck is saying things like, I'll never get there, or I'll never trust in God, or this is really difficult, or I just don't feel it yet. Or I think like looking for a specific sign or moment to connect with God or trust in God, I think limits people, and being able to find that flexibility in that process of learning to trust in God. I just don't think it's the same always.
Right.
But we like things to be the same always.
We like them to be predictable.
Yeah.
But part of what I was thinking when you're saying, hey, it's dynamic, it's not static, I was also thinking, well, I wouldn't actually want it to be. Like, I like the idea of it, but the truth is that sounds really boring, and it doesn't sound like living life if it's static and predictable, and if there's not an ebb and flow. And even the process of love, of accepting love and trusting in the first place, it's not a switch that gets flipped, you know? I've never been completely void of trust, and I don't think I've ever trusted completely. You know, it's like it's in a range, and it's nothing. I've never once fully accepted all of God's love for me. If so, as I said a couple weeks ago, I think I'd die of joy if I did. And so it is going to. We're not looking again. That's magical thinking for that moment where it all clicks, and now I accept the love, and now I can really, 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 really trust. We're always sort of striving, sort of built into it, but we're kind of, I think we're kind of built to strive and to, you know, and to dig. What about you, Robert? What would you say to it?
I mean, I just think it's not an accident. I mean, there's so much deep dive stuff I could look at if we wanted to nerd out on the Bible, but it's not an accident that if you look at most of these kind of patriarchs and big characters in the Old Testament, even in the New Testament, so many of the if you did like a character analysis, like Moses, and he's trying to pawn things off to someone else, and
yeah.
Gideon and the all the little questions, and
Gideon was a mess.
It's interesting, and you finally get to Jacob, and he's wrestling with God, and he's named like wrestles with God. You know, like Israel, such a profound name. It's very clear to me that God does not want a bunch of like American John Wayne Christians. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want movie stars. He doesn't want you with it all put together. Mm. He doesn't want you. He actually doesn't want you to do it all on your own. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want you to like grow up. Live in your mansion by yourself and have no health issues ever. He actually really wants to find you in your weakness. Mm-hmm. And I've run into so many folks, and I would, if I had nothing else I could say today, if you know, when it comes to faith, if you've heard faith or trust in the word or in God means I have this 100% confidence, and like there's not a drip of doubt mm-hmm. or fear or discomfort. Like, that is not biblical. Mm-hmm. That is a lie. Run away from it. Yeah. And in fact, like, that's the very thing you should take to God and take to your pastor, your community. Like, that's a good place mm-hmm. to be. Because if you don't, then what do you have? You either have you striving in your own efforts mm-hmm. and being a, sure, you're a movie star, but you're not mm-hmm. necessarily a Christian. Or it's all your fault.
Yeah.
And I think that was a lot of the bad advice and stuff we got over the years. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just failing at being a good, you know, whatever, good mm-hmm. husband, a good, you know, brother in Christ, a good whatever, you know, like I can't Christian enough. Mm-hmm. And that's it's like not at all what Christ is here for, the weary, you know. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, the weary and heavy laden. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I just think, you were talking about that. I was like, yeah, unfortunately, there are pockets of Christianity where people get pushed toward either that legalism or everything's got to be perfect. And then what's interesting, though, if they sort of give up on that and then pop into especially like a secular social media thing, then they're going to get bombarded with like, especially like the sort of the new wave of influencers who are like, are you crushing it today? Are you giving 110% for 5 hours before anyone else is even awake? And if not, you know, it's like, that's the same stuff packaged
in
just with different terminology,
different vocab.
And it's like, are you completely self-actualized in every way? It's like, no, man, I'm weary and heavy laden. Right. And to that, Jesus says, okay, that's actually who I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Those are the growth places.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason why we grow in the dirt. The reason why poop makes great fertilizer.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Those are the growth spots.
Cool. Yeah. That's where I think like culture, like our culture in America really goes against what Christianity says around being vulnerable and being in community and supporting one another. We do have these messages in our culture just around crushing it and you know, being perfect and doing it on your own and you've got this, and we just aren't hardwired, we're not built that way. And so I think that's where we see mental health problems too, is in this culture of like you having to do it on your own, having to figure it out, being 100% being perfect, and we're not built that way.
And a lot of relationships, a lot of things that we look at in life with that has nothing to do with us, like personally, we start measuring them like accomplishments. Mm. The number of times I'm talking to someone and they're like, I didn't get there. Like I didn't reach marriage with this person, or we didn't have X amount of sex this week or something. I'm like, well, you know, it's 50-50. Like it is kind of on the other person, but like, it's so sad that the person's like a little bit brainwashed, I feel like, by a lot of our cultural standards that you know, well, if you're not doing that, something's wrong, something's horribly wrong with you,
achieve yeah. and we can, I mean, I'm talking to two high achieving, highly educated people who can acknowledge that that doesn't mean don't be ambitious and don't try to do your best, But the constant, unrelenting nail it or it's failure is exhausting and not biblical and not at all helpful. And so one of the things that really stands out from what you guys are saying, and at different times you guys mentioned isolation. I, again, I'm a pastor. My world is church. My lenses are church. And I just think, man, to be meaningfully connected in the body of Christ makes such a difference.
Yeah.
And so I'm so glad you guys are a part of our church. And,
Definitely.
Thanks so much for taking a big chunk of time here. I know you guys are super busy. It was hard to schedule because you're busy, and you would be busy even if you didn't have the dreaded 4 and 2. It's also the most fun 4 and 2. It's also the most exhausting.
They are hilarious.
4 and 6 was most fun actually for us, but
something to look forward to.
4 and 2 is wild. But it's a chunk of time. I really appreciate you guys coming and sharing your expertise. It was really helpful to us. You guys are the best.
Yeah, thanks for having us.